You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network. Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. To call in, we have a secure line ready. Area code 604-525-4167. Again, just call area code 604-525-4167. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. And now your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanic.
Good evening. Welcome to Black Op Radio number 26. It's December 11th, year 2000, and you're here with Anita Langley and Leno Sanic. Hi, Len. How you doing?
Good, Anita. We're going to have Doug Valentine on today.
Again, that's great. We had him back in September and had some serious audio difficulties, so we just had to have him back here again because he has some extremely interesting stuff to talk about. So, Doug, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great, great. Well, we're hearing you much better this time.
Thankfully, yes.
Well, perhaps you could start us off by telling us a little bit of background about yourself. How you came to be a journalist and started writing.
Okay. I'm turning 51 years old tomorrow, so it's been a long road. I've been writing now since 1980, which is when I graduated from college with a degree, with a BA in English literature. Oddly enough, the same year that I graduated from college, my father had his second open-heart surgery, and he was having a very difficult time recovering from it. And he called me up and told me that he had a very interesting story to tell me. Nobody in the family knew it, but he'd been a prisoner of war in World War II. And in order to recover from that first heart attack, his doctors had suggested that he unburdened himself about his wartime experiences. So it was kind of a coincidence. I had just graduated college and himself about his wartime experiences. So it was kind of a coincidence. I had just graduated college, and my father came to me with this story, which I developed into my first book, which is called the Hotel Tacloban, which is what the prisoners in this prison camp in the Philippines called their prison camp. And that's how my writing career began. The book was published in 1984 by Lawrence Hill and Company, and it was published again in 1985 by an Australian publisher, and in 1986 it came out as a paperback. In the process of writing this book about my father, I came to be interested in the problems that soldiers and civilians and anybody who's been involved in a secret government operation, the problems that they have dealing with the secrecy that they're forced to maintain. And that's what led me into the idea of writing about the Vietnam War. I felt that for many Vietnam veterans, they weren't able to discuss their experiences in Vietnam. And I looked for a subject that would be sort of symbolize that situation. And that's where I came up with the subject for my second book, which was called The Phoenix Program, which was about a very secret CIA operation in the Vietnam War. And my second book, The Phoenix Program, was published in 1990 by William Morrow, and in 1992 it came out as a paperback. Since then, I've worked as a private investigator. I worked on for the actor Woody Harrelson, trying to uncover new material evidence to get his father, Charlie Harrelson, who was convicted of murdering a federal judge, getting him a new trial. And I also worked as a private investigator for Dr. William Tepper, who's the attorney that represents the King family. And I testified at that trial in November of 1999, and I've written a couple articles about that. And my third book, which is titled TDY, just came out this 2 months ago. And that pretty much sums up my writing career in the 25 words or less version.
Well, Len and I have both had the opportunity to read TDY, and we were both amazed at how much we felt we were a part of what was happening to this. There was an incredible writing job on your part. I mean, we both felt like we were there. It was very hard to put down. And I have to say that that was one of the most spellbinding pieces of literature I've read.
Yeah, and as I may have emailed you, I picked up your manuscript, the draft, around midnight. I thought, well, I better go over this because I've had it for a couple of days now. And I couldn't put it down until I finished it.
Well, you know, thank you very much for saying that.
6 in the morning, and I'm going, but I, you know, I'm chapter, the next chapter, and I just, you can't put it down. You're in the middle of, well, before we get into that book, let's just go back a few paces, because that book is so spellbinding, we should spend some time on it. But you said that with regards to the secret operations that this doctor thought it was therapeutic for people to get things off their chest, and that was maybe part of why you helped your father out in getting that first book going?
Oh, yeah. With my first book, my father had his first coronary thrombosis when he was 45 years old, and that was in 1971. And it was a terrible experience for the family, and he was just working very hard, two jobs. And, of course, he had a very difficult recovery. And then in 1981, he had his second open-heart surgery. The first open-heart surgery in 1971 open-heart surgery was still experimental in those days. And having a second open-heart surgery in 1981 was sort of an experimental thing, too. And it was in the process of his recovery. He was in a hospital room with other people, but he was having such terrible nightmares that none of the other patients could get to sleep or relax. So they put my father in a room by himself, and they sent a psychiatrist to see him. And my father discussed his dreams with the psychiatrist, and he just confessed that the nightmares he was having were about his experiences as a prisoner of war in World War II. And the psychiatrist said, well, if you want to recover, you're going to have to discuss this, because the only way you can deal with these experiences is to get them off, literally get them off your chest, to relieve the pressure on your heart. My father hadn't told anybody, that anybody in the family or anybody he knew, that he'd been a prisoner of war, because there was a mutiny in the camp, the prison camp that he was in, and my father had participated in this mutiny against some of the officers in the camp who were collaborating with the Japanese. When the camp was liberated, my father faced was given a choice by the military. Even though he only weighed 100 pounds at the time, and he was suffering from malaria and dysentery, just a number of tropical diseases and starvation, and was just in horrible shape, the military gave him a choice that they would either put him up for trial, stand him up on trial for mutiny, or he could accept an entirely new military record. And in exchange for having all his papers changed, he would just have to take this vow of secrecy and never tell anybody what happened. And being 19 years old, which is how old he was when he was released from this camp, he agreed to it, and he, fearing that he would be in trouble if he ever told, he just kept it a secret, and the nightmares and the pressure of the secrecy is what contributed to his heart problems. And apart from the the sympathy I had for my father and just the tragedy of his story, I saw his situation, his predicament, as somehow representative of what happens in America, in American society, where it seemed like his story seemed like an allegory to me, that there's a secret side to American life and American society that we're all forced to internalize. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we don't know what's going on, that there's a CIA out there, that military intelligence and FBI and all these secret agencies that are intervening around the world in ways that none of us are aware of, and yet we all somehow either benefit from this or feel troubled by it because we know that there's a really heavy human, that some other people around the world are paying a very heavy price for this intervention, that there's a human cost to it. And so, in a sense, it became a theme for what I write about, my father's predicament, and it became something that I wanted to pursue in everything that I wrote and everything I did.
Yeah, it would certainly seem to
try and succeed on a couple of levels in making Americans realize what's going on in the country and with themselves.
Yeah, it would seem to be the case in Vietnam that a lot of people came back very disturbed from, you know, things they had witnessed and had to carry out, you know, willingly or unwillingly.
Yeah, well, even that's one thing, but not being able to talk about it, that's rather hard to fathom, and a person has to really feel sorry for the young guys who were involved in that kind of thing, because the stress relief that people get from even just being able to talk about things that happened to them is a healing process in itself, being able to talk about it, and it must have been really hard on your father, 19 years old, and given an option like that, how many people would really turn it down?
Well, nobody would. And I should add that my father, when he went into this prison camp, was only 16.
Yet
he had lied about his age to join the army, so he was just a baby. And lots of people who pay the price for wars and the interventions around the world are young people, especially in Vietnam. I'm sure you know that the average age of the American soldier in Vietnam was 19. The average age of the soldier in World War II was 26. So it was something of a children's crusade. And I should add that after I had written the story of the Hotel Tacloban about my father, and I wanted to write a book about Vietnam, I went to a veterans hospital in New Hampshire, where I was living at the time. And I had a chat with the director of the Veterans Hospital, and I told him that I wanted to write a book about Vietnam, about a part of Vietnam that would symbolize what I'm telling you about, this idea that not being able to discuss what really happened. And I asked him if he thought there was a part of Vietnam the Vietnam War that needed to be written about, and he said, well, yes, have you heard of the Phoenix Program? And at the time, I hadn't. Well, this was 1983. And I said, well, what's the Phoenix Program? And he said, well, there was a patient at the Veterans Hospital who had been in the Phoenix Program, and he would arrange for me to have an interview with this fellow, and this fellow would, you know, tell me what it was all about, and I was very excited. And a couple of days later, the director called me back, and he said he had approached this veteran and asked him to speak with me, but the fellow refused. He was afraid that if he told me about his experiences in the Phoenix program, that the government would cut off his medical benefits. Well, that just got me more interested than ever, you know, and I spent the next 4 years trying to locate people who had been in the Phoenix program and reading everything I could about the Vietnam War and everything I could find that was written about the Phoenix program, and there was very, very, very little. There was only maybe five or six, seven articles written about the subject, and no books. So I just went on this quest to find people who had been involved in the program and ended up speaking with everybody, just about everybody who was involved with it, from William Colby, who was the head of the CIA, right down to the sergeants and corporals and privates who were sort of conscripted into the program and carrying out the assassinations and the kidnappings and the tortures, and were the people who came home terribly affected by sort of the way my father was.
So William Colby, was he very forthcoming about things over there? What did you find was like talking to
him?
Well,
Colby, forthcoming is a unusual word to associate with William Colby. And yet he, in a manner of speaking, he was very forthcoming. He was forthcoming in terms of presenting me with his rationale for it, and he did get into his rationale in depth. And if you would listen to William Colby and believe what he said, you would think that it was a program that had all sorts of safeguards, like Ronald Reagan's safety net, you know, in which if everybody had just behaved properly, nobody ever would have gotten hurt and everything would have been fine. But he was propagandizing me just as he was propagandizing the Senate when he testified before the Senate, and the House before he testified in the House. And he was a very cultivated and glib person who was able to present the Phoenix program in a very benign way. At the same time, I never could have written the book without his help, because in a sense I had conned him. He was under the impression that I was out to write a book that would sort of reflect his views, and for that reason he introduced me to a large number of senior CIA officials. And because he introduced me to them, and he had been the director of Central Intelligence, they, in a sense, waived all their secrecy oaths and spoke very candidly to me about the organizational aspects of the Phoenix program. Because once I had been in, Colby was introducing me to these senior CIA people, all the CIA people started wanting to talk to me to get their point of view across. And before you know it, I was just learning things I couldn't believe. And I would show up at some senior CIA officer's house, or some retired guy, and he'd actually think I was from the CIA because I knew so much about the Phoenix program. It just became a juggernaut, and it was pretty amazing. So I learned an awful lot about it, and when the book came out, and in fact it was a criticism of the Phoenix program, although these people were very disappointed, but so it goes.
Wow, that's an interesting way to get your foot in the door. Have you maintained contacts with any of these people that you met at that time, or were they pretty much, as you say, disappointed, but was that a uniform?
Yeah, to put it mildly, there's very, very, very few of those people that would
return your phone calls now.
Actually, there were very, very few CIA officers who ever spoke out against the Vietnam War. Ralph McGehee was one of the few. I'm sure you people know Ralph McGehee. Wrote a book called Deadly Deceit.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from him, I don't know of any CIA officers who've ever really broken ranks and publicly spoken out against what happened. So in a sense, my book, The Phoenix Program, is the only record that of many of these CIA people speaking frankly about the various aspects of the Phoenix Program. for example, just to give you a good example, through Colby, I got to interview a fellow named John Patrick Muldoon. And this fellow, Muldoon, in 1964, as a CIA officer, was in charge of what was called the Provincial Interrogation Center Program. Through a private construction company called Pacific Architects and Engineers, which the Johnson family had Lyndon Johnson and his wife, Lady Bird, had actually financial holdings in. The CIA, through this company, Pacific Architects and Engineers, built an interrogation center in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. These were secret facilities that were managed by the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. They were, in fact, these were de facto torture chambers. Every province had one. They were all finished by 1966. They were advised, each PIC, they were called PICs, Province Interrogation Center. Each PIC had a CIA officer who was attached to that interrogation center as an advisor. And this is where, it was one of the foundation stones of the Phoenix program, this Province Interrogation Center. Anyway, Muldoon just spent days talking with me about how this whole system of interrogation centers was built throughout South Vietnam. Now, there were literally hundreds of reporters, American journalists, in South Vietnam from 1964 to 1975 when the war ended, all of whom knew about these interrogation centers. And yet, there was not one story written about it throughout the course of the Vietnam War.
Well,
how could it happen? How could it happen that a person such as myself, and I was a tree surgeon for the first 10 years of my adult life, and I went back to college when I was 28 years old because I had bad legs and got a BA in English literature. I just introduced myself one day to Colby. He started introducing me to people, and I was able to find out this incredible secret of the Vietnam War. And yet, Morley Safer and Dan Rather and all those people who were in Vietnam for 10 years, none of them ever wrote about it or found out about it. How could that be?
Yeah, I think that has been explained, actually, in that, that there were organizations that were set up to discredit and cause problems for journalists that ventured too close to stuff that wasn't considered politically correct. Even within the Pentagon.
Goes deeper than that.
I suppose a lot of people just looking after their jobs, maybe patriotism creating a second set of eyelids,
what it is basically is this, and I found this out to be true, is that there's a quid pro quo. I talked with another CIA officer named Tom Donahue, and he was quite a character, and I'll get to my point, and I'll just sort of introduce him a little bit. Donahue was a graduate of Columbia University, and he joined the CIA because he thought it was the Cold War was a growth industry. He'd been gotten a degree in comparative literature. Colby introduced me to him. He was the creator of what was called the Revolutionary Development Program in Vietnam, which created these propaganda teams which went out onto the countryside and under the cover of helping people build their villages, were actually setting up spy networks and assassinating people and stuff like that. Anyway, he told me that a journalist, and I'm pretty sure it was Bob Schieffer, who's a pretty famous journalist in America, used to come to his office every Friday with a bottle of whiskey. And they would sit there and drink. And Donahue would tell Schieffer everything about what was going on with the Revolutionary Development Program. And in exchange, Schieffer would get scoops on specific stories, but the quid pro quo was that he would never reveal Donahue's name, or he would never tell anything about what was really happening. And that's the quid pro quo that goes on every day in American journalism, that the biggest names in American journalism all have contacts in the CIA. And these CIA people tell them everything that's going on. But in order to have access, they can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that simple.
Yeah, yeah. There are lots of ways, I guess, of making sure that happens. As in the case with April Oliver, you can, you know, shut down the military-owned satellites of CNN if they don't do what they're told. But
that's right. And Tom Brokaw wouldn't make $7 million a year if one day he actually came out and said, well, you know, I've been talking to some CIA people, and I know that there's going to be a coup in the Philippines in 3 months from now. But you know, I just thought you all should know that. You know, those kinds of things can't happen, and they don't happen. But they could happen because the journalists are aware of all these secret plans and operations that are going on. They just choose not to do it in order to advance their own careers.
Yeah. I think in a lot of cases you're right. I suppose it depends too in what organization you're working at and what level you're working at. Probably a lot of stuff gets screened before certain producers can even see it. But that said, are you somebody in the field? There's not as many reporters that actually are investigative journalists anymore. They're basically passing around information which somebody has acquired, that perhaps a company has submitted for promotion, et cetera, et cetera. But there doesn't seem to be much actually going out and getting a story anymore.
No. You're exactly right. It's almost as if everybody's reporting everybody else's superficial story. But people have forgotten how to actually get out onto the street and dig around for a story. That takes so much time, and nowadays you have to have a story on what happened 10 minutes ago. There's really no more historical perspective.
Yeah, and now you have no stories and the omission, which is the lack of real stories.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned the Martin Luther King trial. I was amazed at the lack of reporting on that. It was just nothing. I'm scouring the paper every day for that, and there's like maybe the odd thing by Gerald Posner denying everything. But you think that people would be writing about that every day.
Right, and Anita was right. I mean, it's what I was saying about journalists, I meant really just the mainstream journalists. There are a lot of truthful, honest, hard-working journalists out there who are trying to get the stories, but
But if the editor...
They have a hard time getting themselves into print, too.
Yeah, because the editors can just put a hold on it.
Right. So, I mean, it's not too... I painted kind of a broad stroke there, but I was really just...
But you do make a good point.
The mainstream journalists, there are hundreds and thousands of people out there, people of conscience, people who really are searching for the truth, but there are very, very few outlets for them nowadays. There aren't as many magazines and alternative presses getting these sorts of stories out, and the Martin Luther King case is a very good example.
Yeah, no, how did you actually get involved in Martin Luther King in investigating this? I mean, this is a testimony, actually, it must be to your own investigative skills, because you've had your hands in a few different bits of research here, and Martin Luther King, a lot of people would like to know, I'm sure, how you came to be investigating this.
Well, that's an interesting story. When I wrote the Phoenix Program book, I had interviewed a veteran who had been in a military intelligence unit in Vietnam as part of the Phoenix program. And the Phoenix program was having informants in the villages who would, in a sense, rat out people that they suspected of being associated with the Viet Cong, okay? And then the Phoenix people would send out hit teams to go knock them off or kidnap them and put them in one of these interrogation centers that I was telling you about earlier. Anyway, the fellow, this young man, he was a sergeant in military intelligence in Vietnam. When he came back to the United States, he was put in a military intelligence group that operated domestically in the United States. These military intelligence groups no longer exist. Laws were passed in 1974 that made it illegal for the military to spy on American civilians. But during the Vietnam War, and at the time that Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was perfectly legal for these military intelligence groups to surveil civilians. Now, this sergeant who had been in Phoenix came back to the United States, and he was put in a military intelligence group. And in April of 1968, he was in a group in Washington, D.C. And when Dr. King was assassinated, he just heard a rumor from other fellows, sergeants, young guys who were in these military intelligence groups in the United States, that one of the military intelligence groups, the 111th out of Atlanta, Georgia, had a team in Memphis that day, and they had Martin Luther King under surveillance while he was assassinated. They were actually taking pictures of him. They had him under 24-hour-a-day surveillance. And in the process of taking pictures of him while he was assassinated, they had actually taken pictures of the person who had assassinated him. And I wrote that in the Phoenix book. It was like a paragraph or two in one portion of the book, and the book came out in October of 1990. Well, a guy, a reporter in Memphis named Steve Tompkins, who was working for the Memphis Commercial Appeal, read my book, and in 1991, he started looking into the possibility that this actually happened. And he investigated it for 18 months, and at the end of 1993, he published a series of articles in the Memphis Commercial Appeal, which sort of expanded on, brought out a lot about what was actually happening with the 111th Military Intelligence Group in Memphis during that period when Dr. King was killed. Well, Bill Pepper, the attorney for the King family, latched on to his research and started trying to develop the theme as well, okay? And Dr. Pepper called me up, I guess it was around 1995, and wanted to know, a little bit more about what I had heard, and at the time I told him there wasn't really much more to it than I knew of, and I didn't hear about him, I didn't hear from him again. For a couple of years, he finally contacted me again in late 1998 and hired me as an investigator because in order to finally try and look into just how much involvement the military had in terms of surveilling Dr. King at the time of the assassination. The investigator he had been relying upon, this fellow Steve Tompkins, had relied on a lot of unnamed sources and had actually gotten Dr. Pepper in trouble, had told him that a particular guy had led an assassination team into Memphis that day and that the guy was dead, and on a TV talk show, the guy popped up very much alive and recently sued Dr. Pepper and won something like a $10 million judgment.
Yeah, I
so
saw that show.
Pepper hired me to try to figure out where he had gone wrong and what really happened. And that's what I spent a large part of the last 2 years trying to do.
Yeah, I think that was Stone Phillips that ambushed...
Forrest Sawyer?
It was Forrest?
Yeah, okay. Forrest Sawyer, I believe, ABC.
Yeah, it was awful. I was watching that show, and I couldn't believe it.
Right, there was a lot of either Bill Pepper was given a lot of disinformation or it was just shoddy investigative work, but he hired me to try and pull the irons out of the fire and to see, you know, what had gone wrong. And so I spent a lot of time trying to do that. There were basically two parts to my involvement in the King case. The first part was throughout 1999, and that included the work I did up to the trial and my testimony at the trial. And then the second part of the work that I did had to do with what was called the Kowalski Report. The King family had gone to Janet Reno, the Attorney General, and asked that the Department of Justice conduct sort of a parallel investigation. And Janet Reno assigned the investigation to a Department of Justice attorney named Barry Kowalski. And he wrote a report on the trial that was conducted in Memphis in November and December of 1999. And that's the short name for that is the Kowalski Report. But I spent a lot of this last year going over that report and finding out how it distorted the trial, all the contradictions that were in it, the double standard that Kowalski applied throughout his investigation, and really just how the media overlooked what are really some incredible contradictions about the official story that James Earl Ray is the lone assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King. An article I wrote about it recently came out in a magazine called Probe. Are you familiar with Probe magazine?
Yeah.
And, you know, the article's called Deconstructing Kowalski, but I could tell you a little bit about that if you're interested. An article I wrote about it recently came out in a magazine called Probe. Are you familiar with Probe magazine?
Yeah.
And, you know, the article's called Deconstructing Kowalski, but I could tell you a little bit about that if you're interested.
Sure, yeah.
There's basically three things, I think, that are of interest in this Kowalski report. Three main contradictions or problems with it. The case that was held in Memphis in November and December of 1999 was called Jowers versus the United States government. And there was a fellow named Lloyd Jowers who owned a Greasy Spoon Diner, which is across opposite the Lorraine Motel where Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. And James Earl Ray allegedly fired the shot to kill Dr. King from a rooming house that was adjacent to this little diner, Greasy Spoon Diner, that Lloyd Jowers owned. Lloyd Jowers, at the trial, said that it wasn't James Earl Ray who shot Dr. King, that it was a police lieutenant named Earl Clark who shot King from behind the diner, came into the diner, dropped the gun off, and then scooted away.
Wow.
Jowers also said that four people plotted the assassination in his diner. Before I tell you about that, I should say that a jury of 12 people in Memphis reached a verdict that they believed the Jowers and that, yes, in fact, there was a conspiracy to kill Dr. King. The press immediately debunked the whole trial and said it was a farce and a kangaroo, court.
What press we actually heard of it?
Things. They did whatever they could to besmirch it. And Kowalski, in the Kowalski report, reached the same conclusion as the press, but the jury did decide, did reach a verdict that Jowers was telling the truth, okay? And that the federal government was involved in a conspiracy to kill King. What verdict that Jowers was telling the truth, okay? And that the federal government was involved in a conspiracy to kill King. what Jauer said, in effect, was that four people plotted the assassination in his diner, and that these four people were a guy named Zachary, who was the head of the chief homicide detective in the Memphis Police Department. This fellow, Earl Clark, who was a lieutenant with the Memphis Police, Jowers fingered him as the trigger man. There was Earl Clark's partner, who's deceased, and a fourth person named Morell McCulloch. And Morell McCulloch was a young black man who was hired to infiltrate a black revolutionary group in Memphis called the Invaders. And it's with Morell McCulloch that all the contradictions and all the controversy, all that surrounds him. According to Jowers, this fellow Morell McCulloch was the liaison between these Memphis policemen and the FBI and the CIA in plotting the assassination. Well, it gets very interesting. Are you familiar with the House Select Committee on Assassination hearings from 1977?
Yes.
Okay. Very well.
McCulloch testified at those hearings. And when he testified at those hearings, he identified himself as a police officer from Memphis. Those hearings were held in 1977. In 1974, Morell McCulloch entered the CIA, and he only retired from the CIA last year. At the House Select Committee on Assassination hearings, the FBI agent who was in charge of the Memphis office on April 4th, 1968, was called to testify. He was asked if he knew Morell McCulloch, and he said no. However, recently, another FBI agent named Howell Lowell told a reporter down in Memphis named Mark Parasquia that it was actually this first FBI agent, William Lawrence, who recruited Morell McCulloch about 3 months before King was assassinated. And he recruited Morell McCulloch, and they inserted him, the FBI inserted him as an undercover agent provocateur into the Memphis Police Department's intelligence unit. And the chief of that intelligence unit, a fellow named Eli Arkin, who's still alive today, told the same reporter down in Memphis, Mark Parasquia, that Lawrence had in fact recruited Morell McCulloch and had recommended that he be assigned to the Memphis intelligence unit in order to keep tabs on this black revolutionary group called the Invaders. Well, you've all seen, everybody I'm sure has seen photographs of Dr. King on the balcony after he was shot. Well, the first person who reached his side on the day that he was shot was Morell McCulloch. Morell McCulloch lied to the House Select Committee on Intelligence, on House Select Committee on Assassinations, when he said he was a police officer, when he was in fact a CIA officer. And his fellow FBI agent, William Lawrence, lied to the House Select Committee on Assassinations when he said that he didn't know him. Why? Why were they lying? Well, the reason is that the House Select Committee on Assassinations, he suspected back in 1977 that McCulloch was the undercover agent who provoked the riot that occurred in Memphis on March 28th during the sanitation workers' strike, which resulted in the death of a young black man and forced Martin Luther King to return to Memphis 2 weeks later when he was killed. So all this controversy, all of this stuff about Morell McCulloch, none of it has been examined by anybody in the world up until now except me, and a little bit by Barry Kowalski, who couldn't overlook some of these things and actually did a polygraph exam of Morrell McCullough in 1999 for this investigation that he was conducting. And according to the Kowalski report, the results of the polygraph exam were that were inconclusive as to whether or not Morrell McCullough was telling the truth when he denied being part of an assassination to kill Dr. King. And that's where the report leaves it. So anyway, if there's anybody out there who's interested in doing some original research, it would be very interesting to locate Mr. Morrell McCullough and to find out what was really going on.
Yeah.
Another part of the King assassination, the part that Bill Pepper really wanted me to look into, was whether or not the military was surveilling King on the day that he was assassinated. Do we have time for me to get into that a little bit?
Yes, we do. Don't worry about that. We can run over a little bit if we need to. So, no problem.
As I said earlier, I had sort of first reported the rumor in the Phoenix Program book that there had been a military surveillance, and then over the next 8 years, some of that was followed up, but very poorly, and the waters had merely gotten muddied. But what happened in 1999, a very famous researcher named John Judge filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Pentagon for any documents that the 111th Military Intelligence Group might have any records that indicated where and what was going on with the 111th Military Intelligence Group on the day that Dr. King was killed. And he received about 20 pages, which detailed an operation called Lantern Spike. Lantern Spike was run out of the Atlanta office, and it involved a group of 20 people that were sent to Memphis on March 28th. That's 20 soldiers who were in the 111th Military Intelligence Group. And they were sent to Memphis on March 28th, which was the day of the sanitation workers' strike, and it was also the day of the riot when this young black man, Larry Payne, was killed. Because there had been a riot and Dr. King was in Memphis that day leading the sanitation workers' strike, his reputation as a leader of nonviolent protest was damaged, and so he was forced to come back to Memphis on April 3rd and 4th. Anyway, in the documents that John Judge gave me was the name of the officer who was in charge of the 111th in Memphis, and his name is Jimmy Locke. And I did what nobody else had done before, sort of like going to Colby for Phoenix. I just called this fellow Jimmy Locke up on the phone, and I started talking with him. And I asked him, did you send somebody to the top of the fire station? There's a fire station that overlooked the Lorraine Motel. And he said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we did. But nobody had ever asked him about it in 30 years up until that point, which is kind of strange.
Well, what did his commanders tell them to do about that? Were they just supposed to forget they were there?
Well, nobody wanted to discuss it. And so I asked him, well, who did you send? He said, well, I sent a fellow named James Green over there. We all knew that two soldiers had been there that day because a fellow named Carthel Whedon, who was a captain in the Memphis Fire Department, was in charge of the fire station on the day that Dr. King was killed, this fire station that overlooks the Lorraine Motel. And he had testified at the trial in December of 1999 that, in fact, two soldiers dressed in civilian clothes had showed up at the fire station on the day that King was killed and had asked him if they could be brought up to the rooftop. And they had shown him military ID, and being a good, you know, fellow, he led them up to the roof. And that was the last he saw of them. He didn't know how long they were up there or what they were doing up there. All he knew is that they were carrying briefcases. So I asked Jimmy Locke, Major Locke, well, who did you send over there that day and why? And he said, well, he had gotten a request from the 112th Military Intelligence Group in San Antonio that they had a person, they were going to send a person to Memphis to get photographs of Dr. King and his entourage. And when the fellow arrived in Memphis, he assigned Jim Green, the sergeant that was working for him, to go over to the fire station and get up on the roof and take these photographs. Now, all this, you know, seems to suggest all sorts of things, all sorts of possibilities. Well, Barry Kowalski in the Kowalski Report went out and interviewed this fellow, James Green, and James Green, who was the sergeant that went up on the roof, said, testified to the Department of Justice that he had gone to the fire station like 5 days before King arrived in town. And he said that he went with an agent from his own unit, the 111th. So what you have is a contradiction between the commander of the 111th, Jimmy Locke, saying that he sent Green to the fire station roof on the day of the assassination with somebody from the 112th Military Intelligence Group, and you have the guy, James Green, saying that he went there a couple of days earlier with somebody from his own unit, and you have the Justice Department not doing anything to resolve their contradiction. What really happened? And was the second person really somebody from the 112th Military Intelligence Group, or could it possibly have been somebody from the CIA? Nobody knows who this other second person was. So that's another really big problem, that a question that remains to be answered, along with what the hell Morrell McCullough was doing that day. We'll have to find out what the 111th was really doing that day, and what the facts and the truth are. Now, the third big contradiction with the King case and the King assassination has to do with a fellow named Philip Manuel and the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. According to Bill Pepper, it was through the 902nd Military Intelligence Group that it was the 902nd Military Intelligence Group that actually arranged for the assassination of Dr. King. On the day that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, there was a black Memphis policeman named Edward Reddit who was assigned to this same fire station. And he was there to surveil Dr. King and observe what was happening, just as a standard he was part of this intelligence unit, and he was just there to watch and keep track of what was going on. On April 4th, Philip Manuel arrived in Memphis. At the time, he was a staff investigator for the United States Senate Subcommittee on Investigations. He came down to Memphis, and he told the chief of the Memphis Police Department that there was a threat against this fellow Reddit, a threat on his life. And Reddit was removed from the fire station and taken home, and a few hours later, King was killed. The interesting thing is that before Phil Manuel became an investigator for the Senate, he had spent his 20-year military career with the 902nd Military Intelligence Group.
There's a coincidence.
Now, there's a big coincidence, and when I called Barry Kowalski up on the phone, and I asked him how he could explain Bill Manuel's presence and authority to have a policeman removed from his station in Memphis that day, and Kowalski said that he couldn't discuss the subject because Manuel's testimony was sealed.
Okay. Now, of course, anybody would have to ask, but why?
To put it mildly, there's still a lot of loose ends about the King assassination that remain to be tied up. These are very, very significant, important things, but nobody in the major media is interested, and I, as an individual, haven't got the resources to pursue these things, and of course, FBI officials and CIA officials have been perjuring themselves for the last 30 years on everything that happened. So there's really just a trail of lies that any researcher who wants to try and find the truth is going to have to work their way through.
So,
very difficult task.
With William Pepper winning the trial, and the King family, I think, being awarded $1.
Yeah, it was either one or 100.
Yeah.
You know, it was a token. So.
Yeah. Where are things standing today?
Well, the last thing that I know of was that this fellow, Billy Idson, had won a $10 million judgment against Bill Pepper. Idson was the person who was named as the head of this assassination unit that was in Memphis and was reportedly deceased but turned up alive. That's the last that I heard, is that, there was this, in a sense, Pepper's theory was discredited by that fact, even though the jury found for Jowers. The other thing is, you know, the Kowalski report came out and sort of through distortions and a selective presentation of the facts discredited the Jowers trial as well. So, as far as I know, the whole case is just sort of laying in ruins on the ground. There is one attorney in Washington named Daniel Alcorn, who's trying to get more documents on what exactly the 111th Military Intelligence Group and the 902nd Military Intelligence Group were doing on the day King was killed. But the government is stonewalling him. It's very interesting. They said that they lost, they can't find the records of the 111th Military Intelligence Group or the 902nd Military Intelligence Group for those days. The National Archives says the Army has them, and the Army says the National Archives have them. And they're both lying. When I went down to Memphis earlier this year, and I saw this reporter, Mark Parasquia, he actually gave me copies, which had been given to him by the Public Affairs Department at the Pentagon, which were the reports of the 111th and the 902nd for the 2 weeks leading up to April 4th, 1968, and the 2 weeks afterwards. Mark Parasquia got those documents in 1997 and in 1999, and he gave them to me, and I gave them to the attorney and to Bill Pepper. But right now the military and the National Archives are saying they can't find them. Which is another strange coincidence, yes.
Well, it seems that evidence does get lost rather easily.
Especially crucial evidence that, you know, pertains to one of the most important events in modern American history.
Something to do with assassinations. Jamie Scott Enyart, his film, his most important film for the Robert Kennedy assassination, got lost. Amazingly, they found it and then they lost it again.
And then it got stolen on the way.
Stolen, yes, that's right, right. Well, I don't know. It's amazing how that happens, but
it happens.
It happens.
Yes. So, you know, it's very difficult, and people, tend to get discouraged. I know this attorney down in Washington, Daniel Alcorn, you know, is sort of reached an impasse, and I haven't heard from him for quite a while, ever since I gave him the documents that Parascuia gave to me, the documents that he's been asking for and looking for, but I haven't heard anything for weeks, so I really don't know what the status is at this point.
Yeah, but I guess it's hard to tell if they're even, if they're the real documents, because, you know, if the Pentagon gave them to this Mark fella.
Oh, Mark Parascuia. No, they're actual documents, you know, they are real documents. It's just that they're superficial documents, and there's actually more substantial documents that could be gotten, except that the military doesn't want to give them up.
Yeah.
They do have reports.
Well,
if the military does one thing, it generates reports. you don't send a military intelligence group to Memphis with 20 people and not generate daily action and situation and after action reports.
Yeah, there has to be plenty of paper.
This is what the military does, you know.
Yeah.
And all those reports are saved. And they're got, you know, especially reports from the military unit that was surveilling King on the day he was assassinated. So all these things are out there, except that the government doesn't want anybody to have access to them or to see them, which just, you know, sort of brings me back to the point I was making in the beginning. There's this whole secret aspect to our history that we know nothing about.
Well, with people like you helping to uncover it, it won't stay secret forever.
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah. I wonder if we could go back a little bit now to TDY, or I guess forward in some senses. But it would be nice to just be able to discuss the book a little bit before we have to sign off. And, you know, despite what we might say about the book, you know, I'd like to say to our listeners, what we say just doesn't compare to actually being able to read this story firsthand. But,
So first of all, it's available now?
Oh, and it's been out since October.
Right. Where can you get it then?
You can order it at any bookstore, but the publisher is iUniverse.com, which is an on-demand internet book publisher. So.
Great. We'll make a link to that.
One of the easiest ways to get it is to go to iUniverse.com on your computer, punch in my name, and all my books come up, and then you can just order TDY over the internet, and a copy will be sent to you. Or you can go to any bookstore, and any bookstore will order it for you.
Okay.
And there's a couple of other Amazon. You can get it from Amazon.com, or you can get it from Booksamillion.com. It's very easy to get out a couple of places, you know, bookstores on the internet, as well as Barnes & Noble, or, you know.
Right. Well, why don't you give an overview of the book?
Okay. TDY is military jargon for temporary duty, which I suppose should explain that that's what the acronym means. TDY means temporary duty. And the story takes place in 1967, and the central character is a young Air Force photojournalist. His name in the book is Pete. And he was at an Air Force base in New Mexico in 1967, working for the public affairs office as a photojournalist, and he was doing stories on airmen who were doing interesting things, and every once in a while he'd get to do some travel for the base newspaper, but he was basically pretty bored. And so he signed up, put his name on a list for temporary duty missions, which would just be a chance for him to get off the base for a while. Lo and behold, one day, he gets called to the personnel office, and they say that, in fact, a TDY mission has come up, and they'd like him to consider joining it. He just has to go through, you know, a series of interviews before he gets the job. TDY describes the series of interviews that he goes through in order to embark on this TDY mission, which he accepts and which he becomes part of. It describes the team of people that form this this TDY mission and sort of focuses on the major who leads the mission. And then it takes the reader off on the mission, on this TDY mission, which turns out to be something completely different than what Pete, the main character, thought it was going to be. I don't want to ruin the book for
right.
anybody who...
Right, now we'll leave it there.
By telling them what actually happens, because, as you know, it's kind of a short book, and
right.
You can't really talk about too much. If I was to tell exactly what happened, it would sort of give away the story.
So that's a good overview. I think one thing that would make it interesting, though, is that to let people know that, like you said, he thought he was going somewhere, and he ended up out in the jungles.
Yeah, he ends up in the jungles, and he ends up seeing more deeply into the covert operations of the United States government than...
And CIA.
Yeah, and what the CIA was up to in Southeast Asia. He gets a very good view of, because he's a photojournalist,
right.
and he was hired specifically because he was a photographer, and this mission is sort of an investigative mission. It turns into a struggle for survival.
Yeah.
With this fellow having to, being caught in a life and death situation and
well, several.
Yeah.
we don't want to give away too much of the book, but I just can't recommend it enough. And it was, unbelievably gripping, just the writing style. I couldn't put it down at all.
Well,
you know, at 4 in the morning, I'm thinking, man, I'm 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning. you know, I don't read like that, but you can't, once you're on that kind of a journey, and like you say, the preparations that the detail you gave onto the preparation was outstanding, and it was a complete facade. Like the guy thought he was going somewhere when he was just being trained, and no problem. And that could be the precursor to many of these other things. Like you say, people from intelligence units of quote volunteered there end up somewhere, and lo and behold, they're filming an assassination.
That's right. You know, and it's for people who get involved in black ops, which you folks know about. It's not an unusual thing. To be told you're going to be doing one thing and only to find out you're doing, you know, what you're actually being asked to do is something completely different. And of course, the central character, Pete, survives, but like most of the characters in my stories, he's forced to keep a secret for many years.
And that's one thing that I think you should mention, that this book was based on some research of a real incident.
And the person who the story is about is a real person who's available for interviews.
Interesting that this comes around to this theme that you encountered with your own father, and that your research has found that this is not an isolated type of event where somebody is forced to keep such types of secrets for national security reasons or even whatever.
Sometimes it's just simply black. They're simply blackmailed into staying quiet. I mean, that's what happened. My father was blackmailed, and the fellow is from the Phoenix program who felt he couldn't talk to me about it. He was blackmailed because he was afraid he would lose his military benefits, you know, and so it's not just patriots with the CIA who take an oath and then stick to it that get caught up in these covert operations. Lots of times it's people who really are just sort of tricked into it. And then, of course, there's the innocent bystanders who get chewed up in the process as well, you know?
Right. Well, the military does have a history of taking people and using them for whatever purpose they have and discarding them, and I guess basically making them shut up for whatever reason is a good way to just get on with whatever they have to do. I would like to see eventually at some point, you know, all these people who've been forced to be quiet come out over time and just tell their stories. It would make for some very fascinating reworking of history.
Well, hopefully, and also for my, you know, from my perspective, if you look around, America is divided now. I mean, it's horrible, the political divisions in the country. My feeling is that a lot of these political divisions are the result of covert operations. That there's secret policies that we're not aware of. The government affects these secret policies and keeps Americans in a state of confusion and anger at one another, instead of a country that's working together to try and overcome its problems. It's a country that's locked in political stalemate, with everybody just angry at everybody else. I don't want to sound preachy here, but I think that if more and more people would start telling what they know about the covert operations and stop participating in them, that maybe the country could start to heal itself a little bit too.
Yeah.
Because it's basically about healing, getting these things off your chest, telling the truth, coming forward and disclosing what goes on, and facing up to the facts and the awful truth is probably the only way the healing can ever take place. So, you know, it's, in my case, it's not out just to get a good story. I think that pursuing these issues would have the extra benefit of helping the whole country to heal and to become a better democracy and just a better place to live.
Right. I think we could all benefit from a more open society.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And, of course, you know that there's lots of legislation that's proposed nowadays to put further limits on disclosure.
Yeah, I've heard a few things about that type of thing lately. I don't know. All I can say is I hope that they're stalled long enough for people just to get their heels dug in about it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they want to penalize people who come forward.
Well, that's right. Yeah,
imagine
Shelby, you know, has proposed anti-leak legislation, you know, which will become like the official Secrets Act in Britain. And Clinton just he vetoed it recently, but they're going to be proposing it again when President Bush takes over.
Yeah, well, I guess if there's one decent thing there that Clinton did do, I'd have to hand it to him for that one. Glad he did that.
Yeah, I mean, he's not got a string of successes to look back on. He's been as bad as any other president in terms of covert operations, but it just seems to be a tendency of people in power to solidify their power by building a wall of secrecy around themselves.
Right. Well, that said, you've got to keep up the work and tearing down those walls and talking to people like William Colby and getting the goods on them. And, what you had to say about Jowers and whatnot, I thought that was very fascinating. I didn't realize that he had ID'd four people to the degree. I mean, we're not just talking about him saying, oh, there was a bunch of people in here plotting. You know, he gave names and actually identified them.
Oh, yes.
When you start talking about stuff like that coming out, you know, you're bringing forward information like that, and that's a major contribution to people's awareness.
Well, anybody who wants to chat about it with me, I have a website, you know, www.douglasvalentine.com. You can just go there and then send me any questions you have. I'd love to help anybody who's interested in pursuing this further. I just don't have the resources to do it myself, and apparently I'm no longer working for Bill Pepper as an investigator. I haven't heard from him in a couple of months, so
I imagine he's got.
I don't know who's going to pick up the baton and take this thing forward, but I'd be glad to help anybody that does.
I had a number for him in England, but that number's been disconnected.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, I have his email, and, you know, we're in touch every once in a while, but I just haven't heard from him for a while. I think that I know he's coming out with a book, which is he's going to, you know, sort of present the case all over again in a forthcoming book, but I really don't know of anybody else who's doing any investigations into the same case.
He's probably got his hands full a little bit now with this lawsuit that came up.
That may well be the case. Yeah.
Well, even the show tonight is a good vehicle to start bringing it back to the forefront.
Well, I hope so.
Well, it's been wonderful having you here, and thanks a lot for staying the extra time. I think it was very valuable to get the information out that you had with regards to the Martin Luther King, I guess I could say, fiasco.
Yeah.
And really glad that you were with us tonight.
And we'll
welcome.
Heartily endorse your book, TDY, and your other books, which I have not read, but if TDY is any indication... I'll have to be getting up that, I'll have to pick up a few of them soon.
Okay.
And we'll make a link to your website and email address so anybody listening to the show can easily get in a hold of you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having me on the show and giving me an opportunity to, you know.
We'll like to have you on again. Maybe
okay.
In a few months.
Well, I'll look forward to it.
Things of interest pop up. We'll keep in touch via email as well.
Okay.
Okay, thank you then, Doug.
Okay, take care, Lynn. Take care, Anita.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, a very informative night tonight. And a lot of information about the Martin Luther King trial that I had no idea about. As he said, of course, a lot of stuff has just not been reported by the media.
Yeah. And I think he was even being slightly conservative about the amount of stuff that was there. We'll have to make an effort to get William Pepper on and go in depth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope he's not too burdened by this lawsuit that's hitting him. Hopefully that he can shut that off.
Of course, I saw that interview where he was ambushed. It was unbelievable. It was a complete sham of journalism. But we won't continue with that. And, we're looking forward to maybe taking a break, I think, for the next week or two.
Yeah, actually, well, I think it'll be more than a couple of weeks. We're going to come back after the new year starts.
Right.
So, give everybody a bit of a chance to have a good Christmas, and we'll be back in the true new millennium.
Yeah.
Everybody got their partying out last year, except here in Vancouver, where the police wouldn't let us celebrate.
There wasn't much of a party. I think everybody was afraid of Y2K.
Well,
this year, the phone's off there.
Okay, everybody. Well, thank you very much for joining us. This was Black Rock Radio number 26. Good night.
Good night.
Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.